Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCBQ 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 105.0 AM Palm Springs.
Welcome back into the House of Mystery. And I'm Al Warren, and I am at the controls. And in the east coast of the country, from the beautiful city of Boston, we've got David North Martino making the martinis.
I'm right back here doing that. Hey, Al, how you doing?
I am delicious today.
Awesome.
Yeah, it's Friday, you know. So, another beautiful day.
And it's beautiful.
Yeah, and speaking of that, we've got a beautiful guest. We've actually got, he's an author, a speaker, a dancer, he's everything. So joining us, we've got Mark Leslie from the east part of Canada. Thank you for being here.
Oh, I'm delighted to be here. And I am dancing in the hopes that I will get one of those martinis that I've heard about.
Yeah, I'll send one right down.
Oh, thank you, Connie. I'm just a little bit north of you. I can get it from you.
Yeah. The martini can make it across the border, but the Martino can't. Wow. So, Mark, now you are so involved in the writing, speaking world and consulting and all of this stuff. But you look really young. You've accomplished a lot.
It's Photoshop.
I was going to say, but I'm trying to be nice here. We got to promote this. So where did this all come from for you? Like, how did you know this was what you wanted to do?
I think I've known I wanted to be a storyteller my entire life. I've always had a crazy imagination. And, I was always afraid of the monster under my bed and always really intrigued by what if and the paranormal and ghost stories and UFOs and all those things. And so whenever I set to, to put anything down on paper and writing, it ended up being an imaginative what if. So when I was looking at what I wanted to do, my mom was really practical in her advice, and anytime she saw a writer, because I wanted to be a writer, and anytime she saw a writer on a TV show or whatever, and she'd say, hey, look, you notice he's eating Spam? And that's all a writer can afford to eat, so you better get a good job. You're laughing, but I was panicked because all I wanted to do was write, and I'm like, well, I can't live off of writing, so I better get a good job. And so I wanted to have a career that was associated with writing. And when I was in university, I got a part-time job as a bookseller at a chain bookstore in Ottawa, Ontario, and thought, okay, while I starve as a writer, I'll at least work in the industry and I'll be close to books because I love books and I love reading. And so in 1992 is the year after years of rejections, I had my very first short story published. And that was the year I started working in the book industry. And I've loved the fact that I've been very fortunate that my career has grown on both sides. You know, I've starved as a bookseller and starved as a writer all the way through. So. But it's been, I've been really, really fortunate because I've had an opportunity to grow up on both sides of the field, right? The creation aspect and then the business aspect.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I'm saying this mainly because there's a lot of writers, and you probably know this, of course, but there's a lot of writers that are not really into or very good at promoting or being into the business part of books. It's very seldom you get both with one person.
Yeah, you're right. It is. And it's funny because, you know, as writers, we're passionate about telling our stories, and there's this mystique, this misinformed mystique that there was a time when all you had to do was pound on a typewriter and hand your manuscript in to a publisher, and you'd never have to do anything else, and they would do everything for you. Well, that was never really the case in most cases anyways, and that's the thing that a lot of writers don't realize. Is so now, for example, I mean, there's never been a better time to be a writer. There's never been more opportunity. When I started, there was one way of doing it, pretty much, which was, you know, submit your stories and hope you get published in magazines and anthologies. And if you build your name up big enough, maybe one day an agent will take you seriously, and then you can have a book contract with a real publisher. And that's changed, obviously. There's more paths. There's more opportunities. There's not as much gatekeeping because with digital publishing, you know, with the advent of the Kindle and the ability for writers to be able to, you know, self-publish their work to platforms, they've opened themselves up to amazing opportunities where their books and stories can be available in 190 countries around the world, you know, within an hour. And the thing that they failed, you know, it's easy to push a button and publish, and there's so much about the craft of writing, like how to write a good story, how to work with an editor, all those things to make it the best it can be. But there's not really a lot out there in terms of, okay, now what? Right? Because one of the things that a publisher did was they would sell it to the bookstores, and the bookstores would put it in a particular spot, and they took care of that aspect of it. But when now, I like to say the slush pile has moved from the back room of a publisher to the online catalog near you. And so you're now waiting for the discoverability, but just in a different spot. So you're getting rejections by nobody looking at your story or giving you one-star reviews or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. But those ones I always hunt down and take care of. but do you think it's better not having so much of a gatekeeper on? Like, I like the access for people and anybody to be able to put their art out there. But I also feel that we're inundated with a lot of garbage too.
Yeah, we are, but we always have been. I mean, I'm sorry, but I don't need to read a biography of pseudo-celebrities like the Kardashians, right? Like, that's more garbage than than most of the stuff. And that's being published by big publishers, so just because it comes from New York doesn't mean it's good. But I think I look at, so I've had experience in the book industry and where people would bring their self-published work into the bookstores. And yeah, okay, some aren't ready for prime time. But then other ones, and I'm thinking of Canadian author Terry Follis, who you know, got rejections from publishers for his very first book that he wrote. And then he went out and released it via a podcast. And he was using like a podcast feed to read his story. And he was getting listeners from around the world about his book about a satirical novel of Canadian politics, which, I mean, you know, nobody would ever want to read anyways because it's just such a weird concept. But the best laid plans, I found out about this when it was self-published and I was working in a bookstore and I ordered it non-returnable because it was a print-on-demand book from a vanity outfit. Right. But I had listened to it and thought, oh my God, this guy is brilliant. It reminds me of some of John Irving's early work, The Humor, and some of Robertson Davies' work, which I love. And I thought, oh my God, I got to have him come into my bookstore. Terry ended up winning an award for that book, Stephen Leacock Medal for Humor. And then he got an agent, and then eventually Penguin Random House in Canada picked up his books. And I think he's working on his eighth book with them now, and there was a TV series based on that first book, a mini series on CBC here in Canada, and also a stage play adapted from The Best Laid Plans. And so I look at something like that and think, had Terry not had access to be able to self-publish this work, the literary world in Canada would not have been privileged enough to have access to read and enjoy his work in so many different formats. Just think of that first book and all the adaptations. And so sometimes the gatekeeping, and this would happen regularly, is a really, really good book would get all the way to an editorial board. And because of the amalgamation of all the major publishers, there's only five big ones right now, there would be probably hundreds and hundreds of great books that don't get published every year because they're like, oh, well, we already have a satirical novel, you know, contemporary satire, and we only have room for one. So what I love about this, and I think is the democratization of the slush pile, meaning, okay, you know, let's assume that they're doing their best work and they're getting it edited and it's actually ready for prime time. Let's let the readers decide what they want. And I love that. It's in podcasting, in publishing, you can go as niche as you want, and there's going to be some ideal readers there for you, most likely, provided you've done a good job of putting together your best work.
So what do you think the answer is then? Because so many, there are really good writers that are self-publishing, that are not going through the big publishers, or they go through small publishers.
Right.
And there's no real promotion. So is there a key to success for someone that's, you know, doesn't have a whole lot of people behind them?
I like to say, as I've said in Seven P's of Publishing Success, three of the key P's are patience, practice, and persistence. It really is a matter of persistence and you know, continuing to work at your craft and picking yourself up and going again. But I think the other thing that's really, really critical, and so many writers forget this, is thinking of their audience first. I mean, so they have a book. They have something that they've written. They really, really need to hone in on their audience. And anyone who says, oh, this book is good for everyone, you're sadly mistaken. I'm so sorry. It may end up being a book that lots of people love, but you really need to hone in on that that core reader. And I'll give you an example. I mean, when Stephen King, I think you've probably heard of him. He's an up-and-coming writer. But he addresses constant reader. Constant reader is one person he's writing to. He's referring to Tabitha King, his wife. And when he writes a book, he wants to please Tabby, and he's got her in mind the whole time. Will Tabby like this? Will Tabby hate this? She's a constant reader. Now, fortunately, he focuses on that one reader. He's done okay for himself doing that, right? Like that narrow, narrow focus. Another example that I'll use is the first book I pitched with Dundurn, which is Canada's largest independent publisher. It was Haunted Hamilton, Ontario, being the town of a city I was living in. And when I pitched the book to Dundurn, I did kind of like a Venn diagram pitch. And I said, well, this book will appeal to folks who love ghost stories because it's ghost stories of Hamilton. But then there's another circle of people who are passionate about their city and love their city and just want to read anything about their city. And then the third core are people who love history, especially local and Canadian history, because a lot of the War of 1812 and stuff like that factors into it, and you can't tell a good ghost story without getting into history. So when I pitched it, I focused in on the overlap of all those three demographics and said, that's my target reader, and that's who this book is for. And I think writers really need to take that exercise, whether they're traditionally published or they're self-published, and understand who their core reader is and focus on them. And that's probably the thing a lot of writers are not spending enough time doing.
Right, right. Now, it seems to me that you write a lot of horror, a lot of scary sort of books. What draws you to that?
Fear. I'm afraid of everything. No, you laugh. That's so true. I'm afraid of the dark. I really, truly am. When my son was little, I was so terrified he was going to come into the room and say, you know, Dad, the boogeyman's in my room. Instead of telling him there's no boogeyman, I would go, okay, come on, hide under the covers with me. The covers are magic. They'll protect us, right? I've always been frightened of things, of the unknown, and always curious at the same time. Kind of like, you know, being afraid of heights, but enjoying going on roller coasters and stuff like that, right? So I get a charge out of it. And I guess my writing has always wanted to explore those dark crevices. I think one of the, a good friend of mine, Kevin J. Anderson, I was talking to him early during this pandemic, and we were talking about the importance of fiction during stressful times and dealing with adversity. And he says the one thing you can do in fiction that's brilliant is, like, really bad things happen to people, like people you love, really bad things happen in the world. In your fiction, you can control it, and you can make good things happen, right? You can send them to the brink of disaster, and then things can get redeemed, and you're in control of this world. And I was like, yeah, you're right. In a lot of fiction, for example, I mean, a lot of my horror, well, not for the short stories, because you can kind of get away with murder there easily, but with longer works where people are invested in them, yeah, usually the good guys win, right? Good prospers over evil. And that's, for at least for my longer fiction, that's been a constant theme.
Yeah. But when you say this comes from a spot where you have fear, that you do have a relationship with fear. So in a way, you're exposing some of yourself. You're putting your own emotion into it. It's not just a story that you can have a happy ending to. So with that being said, where does the comfort or where does the confidence come that allows you to expose something in a book like that that anybody can read and nowadays anybody can comment on?
Yeah, that's interesting. That's a scary thing. I remember interviewing Canadian author Julie Cherneda after her first book came out. She had a background writing biology textbooks before she did her first piece of fiction. And after having read, worked as a professional writer for years, it was the novel that terrified her the most. And she said, and I'll never forget this, it's like standing naked on the front lawn to have a book, a fiction book out there, because it's not researched material. And yeah, every bit of fiction is like that. So my mom, God bless her, but my mom is always funny because when she reads a story, she doesn't even think that my characters are made up people, which they mostly are, although there's a lot of me in many of them. But she's like, and then you did this, and then you did that. I'm like, no, Mom, it's fiction. That wasn't me. I didn't do any of these things. It's like, this is a character. But the reality is a lot of the characters often start with imagining myself in the position and then adapting into another perspective. And there is a lot of exposure, especially in fiction, but even in my nonfiction, the tutorial stuff and helping other writers, I do share a lot of personal anecdotes. I've even had editors go, no, you don't want to go that deep. You don't want to go that far. But I have found through my podcast as well as through some of my writing is that every time I worry, I was like, oh, I think I put a little bit too much of myself in there. I think I revealed a little bit too much. I found that those are the things that resonate with readers, because somebody else will come back and go, oh my God, me too. I didn't realize that. But when you said it, I immediately connected with you. So what are we doing as writers? What we really want at the deepest, most profound level is to connect with another human, right? I have a story I'm going to tell you. I'm going to tell you, like, you know, in the cave, I'm going to tell you about, you know, the cave drawings. I'm going to tell you how I captured this meat that we're eating, right? And that's a story. And that's, you know, fundamental storytelling going all the way back to its roots. But when we put it on paper or in other guises and someone else consumes it, it's us connecting with another human. And that, I think, is why it's terrifying when I share, but it's also so exhilarating when the right reader picks it up and connects with what it was that I created.
Now, we were talking earlier before we went on air that we actually shared pages in an anthology, a short fiction ghost anthology.
Yes.
And I was just wondering, you know, you write short fiction, you write novels. Do you prefer short fiction? Do you prefer writing in the longer form?
Oh, yeah, it's interesting. Yeah. So the thing I like about short fiction is I can get I can exercise those little demons a lot faster than they don't need to be as complicated. The other thing, and I learned this from Jeffrey Deaver in his short story collection Twisted, is you have a contract with a reader in a novel length work, like a longer, like, you know, when you're looking at anything beyond 20,000, 30,000, 40,000 words. And that contract is that, God, I'm investing all this time. I better have a happy ending, or the good guys better win, or, you know, something like that. With short fiction, all bets are off, right? You don't have to have a sense of character preservation. You can play with the reader. You can trick them. You can twist things. You can do, and a lot of my short fiction is Twilight Zone style. Just twisted and weird, strange fiction, because the world doesn't need to make sense. It's like almost like poetry in many ways. It can be experimental, and I can just paint a scene. And the whole purpose of the story is just to get this one element across, or this one visual imagery that I want to portray. I don't know, David, do you find the same thing?
Yeah, I find that I do like to delve into the short fiction allows you to have that narrow focus. You get to really look into just that story, that character. And when you do novels, you get to breathe a bit.
Yeah, yeah. You can also kind of ruminate a little bit longer on some things, right?
Well, absolutely.
I would imagine that the big difference would be the development of the characters.
Well, the development of the characters on the page, right? You may still dedicate time in your head to that character, but it never shows up on the page. Whereas in a novel, you have more opportunity to pull out the photo albums and go, hey, and let me tell you about this and let me tell you about that. Whereas in a short story, you're like, no, I don't have time for your photo albums. Let's just cut to the chase.
Yeah, get to the blood.
As it were.
Yeah. Fear and Longing in Los Angeles. Okay, so that's the Canadian Werewolf Book 3. So this is a part of a series, obviously. So what is a Canadian werewolf?
So a Canadian werewolf was me falling in love with New York on my very first visit to New York and walking down through Battery Park and just, I don't know what it was, I imagined something. Oh, and it was based on an anthology I was writing a short story for. And the anthology was themed, and I'm not sure if you remember seeing the call for this years ago. It was The Monster Within. And they were looking for short stories where they looked at the man behind the monster. And so as I was walking through Battery Park, I was thinking, imagine, I don't know why, but this is why I imagine these things. Imagine I was a werewolf and I lived in the city. And where would you go to be a wolf at night? You turn into a wolf. What would happen? What would happen if you woke up naked in Battery Park with a bullet hole in your leg and the taste of human blood in your mouth? And, of course, you have no memory of what it was like, what you did the night before as a wolf. How would you deal with that? And so the story that I wrote called This Time Around was about a man living in Manhattan who does that. And the whole purpose of the story is to find some clothes and to get to this morning appointment across the city. Like, how is this naked man going to solve this problem? And so in that story, I had him, he has enhanced powers, so he has enhanced senses and strength because of the wolf blood coursing through him. And it resolves that story. But a good friend of mine, Sean Costello, who's a horror novelist, he read the story and said, this is awesome. What happens next? And I said, well, nothing. It's over. But then he kept bugging me and prompting me. And I said, well, what if I explored the rest of his day? And so A Canadian Werewolf in New York was the novel that I first started to write in 2006 for NaNoWriMo. I finally finished it in 2014 and published it in 2016. And it is the day in the life of Michael Andrews, a small-town Canadian like myself, very much based on me, and maybe there's a wish fulfillment because he's a writer. He's a successful writer, so he's a little bit of a celebrity, and he's living in Manhattan, trying to deal with the side effects of being a wolf, and he happens to have grown up reading Spider-Man comics like me and feels that with great power comes great responsibility, and he uses these powers to help others. And so that was a fun novel to explore, and I didn't even realize I was writing urban fantasy. I called it a humorous thriller when I first published it, and I even used a cover that was not applicable. Like because I didn't realize that it was until Raider said, "Oh my God, this reminds me the humor in this reminds me of Dresden from Jim Butcher, the Harry Dresden." And I was like, what? I've never read any of his stuff. I should check it out. And I'm like, oh, hey, wow, maybe this is urban fantasy. But you never really see him as a wolf. You only see him as a human. So that was an important aspect. So I think I eventually worked with somebody to help revise the blurb. And I came up with Alpha Wolf, Beta Human, Big Apple. And that's sort of the premise of that first book.
I mean, I wake up naked in New York all the time.
Oh, yeah, of course, yeah.
I mean,
who doesn't?
Yeah, who doesn't? It's what you do. It's what one does in New York. I mean, hopefully without all the bullet holes, but, you know.
Yeah.
But when you say that, you know, it came to you from, you know, your first visit to New York, you fell in love with it, you started thinking about what a werewolf would do or what a human that had this would do or if they woke up. So are you, in essence, writing New York as a character? Like, is the scene a character as well?
Yeah, you know, it's such a great question. I was, fortunately, I've been, since I started writing that, I was in New York twice. But I've now been to New York, you know, dozens and dozens of times and spent plenty of time exploring different neighborhoods. And what I love about that city is each neighborhood, each area has such character and such vibrancy and such community. It reminds me of these little pockets of small towns, all nestled together and interacting with one another. It's such a beautiful thing. So that is, in many ways, it's like that. But I remember early on, I reached out to Dennis Hamill. Now, he's a novelist, but he's a columnist for a New York newspaper. And I loved his writing, and I had only been to Battery Park once during, you know, the middle of the afternoon, and so my scene was set, like, you know, at the crack of dawn. And I reached out to him, as you sometimes just reach out to people you admire, and said, hey, you're for, like, because he writes about Brooklyn, and Brooklyn is a character in all his stories, and it's just, I fell in love with Brooklyn reading his novels. And I asked him, like, you know, what's it like in this time of day in this neighborhood? Would you know? And he came back and he shared so many insights as to what would be, what you would see, smell, and hear. And then he gave me this unsolicited writer's advice that I use to this day and I adore. And I even added it into the book because I had my character reach out to Dennis Hamill, and then I had Dennis Hamill provide him the same advice as a mentor. And it was go and take a walk with your character. Walk down, you know, walk through Battery Park with the character and just listen to what your character notices. What do they talk about? What do they see? What do they pay attention to? What do they attend to? And whenever I get stuck in writing, I will take my character for a walk. And people may look at me strange as I'm talking to myself, but I always
well,
find
New
it
York, to, that's
well, not New York, that's true. They think maybe I have earbuds in and I'm just on a call. But it's such a great exercise because I know what I see, but I go, well, wait a second. If I were in his shoes or her shoes, how would I perceive this same thing? And you go, oh. And then you see something. And then that becomes part of the story.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds. And they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
It's very interesting. And that kind of brings up, we were talking to another writer yesterday. This author brought this idea up that about inner monologue. And I was just wondering, when you write, do you have an inner monologue in your head when you write, or is it more images and symbols that you're seeing and that you're trying to translate into words?
Oh, I think
that's understandable. Yeah.
No, it's a great question. I think, I mean, sometimes I'll visualize something, but oftentimes it's a monologue. It's always a monologue. I mean, I can't shut off the inner monologue that's going on there. In my mind, like my day, it's like a comic book, and there's the little square boxes about at the top of the comic that are kind of explaining. It's the dude from Twilight Zone, Rod Serling, stepping out and saying, "Picture this, a man is going to make breakfast." Like any of those things. Like I can't turn that inner monologue off. So all I do when I'm writing is I just point it at the thing that I want to write about.
Well, as long as it doesn't start telling you to shoot people or something.
Well, so far so good. I've been able to kind of suppress those ones.
Really different concept for me because I've done several books, but they're all true crime or they're nonfiction, you know, cults and all the things like that. So I don't see the characters in my head and I'm not listening to them and I'm not going for a walk with them. So explain that part of what a character is to you. And I say that because a lot of the authors will say, you know, they describe them as their children or their friends, their family. What is the character to you?
Yeah, they're like the imaginary friends who let me in on their lives. I was talking to my partner about this just last night because she said, Is it true that writers, you're actually, you know, you go to write something and you have these plans for where a story's going to go? And no, the writer, the characters had a different idea than I did. And they took me in a different direction. She goes, you know, that's bull, right? That's not true. It's like, it's you. You're controlling it. I was like, no, they wanted to go there. I just was writing down their dialogue and their dialogue happened to go in that direction. Which is kind of a weird thing to explain, but it's happened in two of my, in a novella in the Canadian Werewolf series, and it happened in Fear and Longing, where I had these preconceived plot ideas and go, okay, I need this to happen and this to happen so that this can happen. And while I was trying to force my characters and puppets to go through these motions, they developed their own sense of what they wanted. And it was kind of like, oh, God, no, I guess I have to explore that now. Okay, so I'll just follow them for a while. Which turned into, I mean, ironically, Fear and Longing in Los Angeles, I had to split it and do a different story arc resolution for that book and then a longer story arc that's not going to get completed till the next book in that series.
So in that book, in Fear and Longing, Michael Andrews, who is that?
So Michael Andrews is the main character. He's the wolf that only very few people know that he's actually a wolf. So it's not. It's in a world that's like ours. And he is in love with this woman he met years ago doing research for the occult years ago. They fell in love. They ended up splitting up, but they became friends. And Michael's always been in love with her and knows, because he can sense her. She still loves him, but she can't trust men and she can't have a relationship. And so he's always wanted more. And at the beginning of Fear and Longing, his agent, who always mocks him and makes fun of him because he's an alpha, he's a beta human. He's a pushover. He's like whining and moping about this woman. And he's like, no, I'm sending you to LA. I've got you a job as a script consultant on, they're adapting your latest book into a movie, and you're going to be there for 3 weeks and you're going to be working there and you're going to get this damn woman out of your head. And that's where the longing comes from. And then he's in LA on the set, and the fear comes from this, hate group, known as the Proud Fighters for America. And this hate group is in LA, and they're causing all kinds of, and a lot of the scenes were inspired by The Purge. You know, they're in these costumes and masks, and they're just terrorizing neighborhoods. They're terrorizing minority groups. They're terrorizing LGBTQ members, all of these things. And, of course, Michael, being the Boy Scout, can't help but want to get involved and help. But he also falls in love with a woman while he's there, which is what he was looking to do, is just to find some distraction. But, of course, she may be tied to this hate group. So he's finding himself getting involved deeper and deeper in this really dark aspect of LA.
I just wanted to go back just a second to your inner monologue, because I had wanted to ask you about, a lot of writers like to write with music, like a big wall of sound. And some like to write in total silence. And I find that for me, because of how I, the voices in my head get drowned out, right? by too much rhythm or lyrics or anything like that. I have to listen to like ambient music. I was just wondering how it was for you when it comes to when you're composing prose.
Oh yeah, that's a great question. Now, I mean, music is always in my head. I love music. I'm a very musical person, but I cannot listen to music with lyrics. Because the lyrics get in the way. They get into my writing. And so it's ambient music, it's soundtrack music, it's classical music, it's, electronic music. It's kind of interesting because I'm an earworm kind of person. And music will make its way into the book. So I'm a huge fan of the Canadian rock band Rush. And of course, there are so many Easter eggs for Rush fans in my books, especially in the latest one where Michael reflects on how something reminds him of a song. Now, it's really, really, you've got to be careful, right? You can't use lyrics in your books for obvious copyright reasons. But I was lucky. I'm a huge fan of Alicia Witt. Are you guys familiar with Alicia Witt, the actress and musician?
Yeah, I do. Yes,
I mean, she's been in everything, right?
Yeah.
So she's an indie musician, and I supported one of her last Kickstarter projects on a project where, and one of the levels I supported her at was she wrote a custom song for me, and I used that song to propose to my fiance, my girlfriend at the time, now my fiance. And Alicia was kind enough. She was on tour. She was coming through Toronto, Ontario. And it was on my 50th birthday. She was in Toronto that I said, hey, could you perform it live? And I'll propose to her after you perform the song, which is called Liz, which is a beautiful song she wrote. And so I also asked her if it would be okay if I included her in Fear and Longing in Los Angeles as a character, because I wanted Michael to go visit her at the hotel cafe where I knew she played when she lived in LA, because it's set in 2017. And of course, listening to her Phil Collins style, really emotional breakup songs are really, allow Michael to get over Gail. He finally gets it, right? Cause he hears the music, and the music makes a huge difference because it's such a powerful impact. And then I sent it to Alicia before the book was published and said, hey, here's that scene I was telling you about. Is this okay? And she allowed me to use some lyrics, which is phenomenal. And then she came back and said, wow, that's exactly what I would have said in that situation. That was perfect. Because I have him, I have her talk to Michael. And the cool thing was for the audiobook, she let me use snippets of those songs, which she owns all the rights to.
Wow.
Because she's an indie musician. So it was like this beautiful, beautiful harmony. So music, it was funny you talked about that. Music is really embedded throughout the book in really powerful ways.
Wow. It sounds like a pretty complex story, but also, is there a subtext? Is there something you want people to get out of this book besides the story?
Yeah, I think Michael has to come to terms with destiny. He believes he's destined to be with Gail, and then he ends up falling in love with somebody else. He believes he is destined to use his powers to help other people, and he has to come to terms with whether or not that's the right thing to do. And so there's a lot of that destiny, I think, is part of the larger thing. I was, you know, you always wonder, you know, when you're either in a relationship or in a situation, is like, was I meant to do this? And you sometimes question yourself. And so that's a lot of the underlying things going on in this book.
Is a Canadian werewolf different than an American werewolf?
Well, yeah, of course. They apologize.
I was going to say, yeah, do they say sorry every time?
They say sorry and they say, I'm going oot now.
Yeah, I'm going oot, yeah. And they say they're sorry. And do they howl and go, hey? Howl?
Hey! Yeah, it's like, ooh, hey. Yeah, it's something like that, pretty much. No, the whole idea is he's a small-town Canadian living in the Big Apple. And then that just became the series name, Canadian Werewolf.
Yeah. Well, no, I think that's a really good image there. If, you know, someone that, going to such a large center in the country of the U.S., right? So
yeah,
there's so much going on there. Do you have to go to those places in order, like, so with L.A., do you have to go there and hang out to get a feeling for it?
I don't have to, but I have, and a lot of of both those novels were based on places I've been and spent time in and enjoyed and said, oh, I'd love to set a scene here. But it was really cool. I was watching an episode of Lucifer from the latest season on Netflix the other day, and they showed a pan over Venice Beach. And I'd been to Venice Beach, but I've never been to the neighborhood like that looks like Venice with all of the canals. But I had Michael and Lex, the woman he's falling in love with, walking across the bridges of the canals. And that was based completely on me doing Google Maps and kind of walking, you know, you can do the street view and you can walk through. And as I was writing the scene, I was walking and saying, okay, here's where they are now. Oh, and they're going to stop on this bridge and have a conversation. So I wanted to know what it would look like from their perspective. So no, when I haven't been there, oh, thank goodness for places like Google Maps and street view and stuff like that.
Sure makes life easier today. Even the old manuscripts and typing and then sending it in and stuff like that by mail. It's such a difference.
Oh, yeah, night and day.
Yeah, it's crazy. How far do you want to go with this series?
It's funny. I didn't think it was going to be more than one book, and then I had some readers that were just like they wanted to see more. And as I explored it, I've embedded a few things, even from the beginning book, where I haven't answered why. Why does this one character keep showing up out of the blue? Why does he seem to always have an agenda, but we don't know what it is? So I've built a lot of these questions that I know I'll answer later on, but I'm not sure when I'm going to answer them. So right now, I'm enjoying writing it. The readers that are coming back to me are looking forward. Like, I've already got tons of pre-orders for the next book coming out in December that I haven't even started writing. But I think as long as I'm having fun and as long as the readers are having fun, I'm just going to, I can probably see doing another probably half dozen.
So it's real important what the readers and people that, so do you get involved in social media a lot and the aspect of people that review your books or things like that?
When they call me out in social media or tag me on Twitter or Instagram or whatever, I definitely want to interact with them because they're tagging me because they want to interact. And I want to know what they think. I want to know how they feel. Now, reviews are difficult. I do read reviews and I take them with a grain of salt. And that's both the 5-star reviews and the 1-star reviews. But oftentimes I'll look at the 1-star reviews and go, okay, how did I miss? Did I mess up because I marketed to the wrong person? Or is there something in what they're saying that I can take back and make my writing better? But I love that interactivity because I've been so lucky that writers I've admired, when I've reached out to them, oftentimes they'll, you know, be kind enough to reply. And I always figure if somebody's out there and they want to engage and interact with me, then I'm lucky to have them as a reader, and I don't want to leave them behind. I want them to feel part of the process.
Yeah, it's interesting. But you don't, come on, you don't get into fights with one stars.
No, I've learned. That's the business of writing is you don't argue with one star reviewers. Although I have, I've taken one star reviews and made a book better. I've gone back on something and said, oh my God, he's so right. I'm marketing this to the wrong people. I changed the title. I changed the cover. And I'm like, okay, now I'm the thank you one star review person. So, there's always something to learn, right?
Yeah, there always is. I mean, you can always look at it that way and, hopefully get better. What is the most important thing you think for a writer? So someone that's new to the business or the process of writing, what piece of advice would you say is the most important?
I think one of the things that resonates well with me is I'd always avoided tropey horror monsters. Like, I never wanted to do a vampire or a werewolf or any of the tropes because I was like, well, it's all been done before. And it's the same thing as I didn't expect I'd be writing a werewolf series. Well, there's lots of werewolf series books out there before. But the reality is you're the best person to write that unique book. You're more qualified than anyone else to write that book that you've just written because you're applying your own perspective, your own point of view, your own characteristics. And so even if it is a story that's been done before, they all have been done before, it's that uniqueness of you that's going to make it special in what it is. And I think it's really important for writers to not lose sight of that. There's probably a story that they're passionate about wanting to tell, and to focus on that and not worry so much about, oh my God, someone else has already done this. Just focus on getting that out there, because there is probably an ideal reader who's just going to resonate with it and love it, hopefully.
Yeah. Yeah. It's more about what you can do with it. I always say that even on radio shows or podcasts, just what as many people as want can interview Mark Leslie, but it's what I do with him that's
exactly
different.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So classic horror, classic sort of writing, or modern stories, which kind of do you lean toward?
I love all of them. I mean, I've gone back and reread classics. Like, I only read, I think it was within the last 10 years that I actually read Frankenstein and gave it a rating and went, oh my God, this is brilliant.
Yeah.
But there's new stuff coming out all the time that is just phenomenal. And it's always fun. I sit down and I go, wow, I wish I had done that. Such a great story. So for me, it's a combination of wanting to seek out new voices and also going back, and so many books I haven't had the pleasure of enjoying is like, well, it's lasted. There's got to be a reason. There's got to be something. And there's usually some human elements to it that just, you know, still resonate to this day. I mean, one of my favorite essays is Walking by Henry David Thoreau. It's based on a speech he gave. And you can read that essay today and think he just wrote it last week in a lot of cases of things that he talks about, because it's not all that different. Even though, you know, the technology is dramatically different. It was a dramatically different world. But I love when writing can do that, when it can transcend time and space like that.
Yeah, I've actually just been listening to Frankenstein and Dracula myself, audiobook at night. And it is amazing, some of the old classics, I think. But the story is the key, right? It's the most important thing.
Yeah, I think so. I think it really is. I mean, the characters and the story and all of these aspects. But yeah, I think that's really, really important. Because if it was powerful and it touched people, it's probably still going to do that.
How do you like people to interact with you? So what is your contact information, website, social media? What do you like?
Well, I'm at markleslie.ca, and all my social media is there. I mean, I've got a YouTube station. I'm on Instagram. I'm on Twitter. I've got a Facebook page there. And it just depends on, I'm kind of playing around on all of them and experimenting all of them. Yeah. I'm happy with whatever way people want. There's contact forms if people want to reach out and email me directly. I'm pretty available.
Signed pictures,
nude photos, like whatever people are looking for. Like, that's all over the
place. Now we're.
Oh, no, wait, no. Liz told me I can't do the nude photos anymore. Sorry. Okay. Just signed headshots.
Oh, well, I guess we take what we can, right? You know. Hey, so how has this pandemic or anything, you know, the last year and a half, you know, all the turmoil with the pandemic and the Trump thing and the U.S. and just everything going on. When that's surrounding you and in us in the world, does it make a difference in your writing?
I haven't, I haven't written in my fiction. I haven't written about the pandemic. In my nonfiction, true paranormal thing, I haven't written about the pandemic. I've written about the pandemic in parody. Liz and I have done parody music videos and songs, and I've covered them. So I think, it has affected me in pandemic. Even, I did a parody of the best TV show in the universe, Cheers. I'd always grown up wanting to have a place like that. And because I love going to bars and I love just interacting with people, and I'm a very social, drinker. We have a bar at home. And so I did this cheesy parody of Cheers called Mark's Tavern. And it's basically about me being stuck at home and imagining that I'm drinking with a bunch of other me's. And I used video to actually, you know, transpose myself multiple times in the same video. And it's like serving Marks since 2020. So the pandemic has definitely affected my parody writing for sure.
Well, being that you're a horror writer in general, when something dark is surrounding you, even you might not write about it like the pandemic itself, but if bad things are going on around you in your life, do you think that affects, do you get like a darker sense of writing, or do you find that you go the other way and try to be more light?
I think, well, obviously it's because I've done a lot of parody and comedy, I think I've gone light to try and, if I can bring a smile to someone else's face, but I'm going to probably have to face this soon because I started off Canadian Werewolf in 2016, time-wise,
right.
And 2017 is where the latest book happens. So eventually, if I keep going, there's going to be a pandemic around them, and I'm going to have to figure out how Michael's going to navigate it. Now, fortunately, what I love about this is I'm going back in time, so I know the phases of the moon based on what actually happened to any major events. Like even I had him appear on the David Letterman show in the first novel, and I had to set it before Letterman retired, because, you know, I had to be somewhat realistic.
Yeah.
It's interesting. It hasn't been the core of anything I've written yet, but I'm sure it will as it hopefully becomes a part of history.
You were just talking about beer, right?
I always talk about beer.
Right. I know you're passionate about craft brews and I'm a whiskey drinker myself, and I'm just wondering, do you bring either your love of beer or other activities or hobbies or anything like that into your stories?
So Liz and I have been working on a book called Spirits Untapped, Haunted Bars and Breweries, for the last 5 years. We love researching it because we've visited so many great places. I don't think we'll ever stop researching. But interestingly, I drink. I like whiskey. I like beer. I like all the things. Michael isn't so I have him in fear and longing in Los Angeles getting drunk a lot and not being able to deal with it because he can't handle his booze. So it was really fun writing a character who's so that aspect is so unlike me. It's funny. I haven't normally I would have a character talk about their favorite craft beer and stuff like that. Now I did. I did set it in a there's a scene in a brewery that's based on a real place that I can't wait to visit, called Phantom Carriage Brewing, which has like a horror theme. And I've sent a friend of mine there. I was like, after the pandemic, I can't wait to get my butt down to Southern California and go check that place out. I did have Michael's appreciation of the taste of these craft beers, even though I haven't yet enjoyed one of their beers myself.
You never know what's going to happen.
Exactly.
So how much, or what's next for you? So you've got Fair and Longing in Los Angeles. So I know as a writer myself, you've probably got a lot of projects going at once. Kind of what is next for you?
So the next book in the Canadian Werewolf series, which I went and commissioned the cover while I was three quarters of the way writing Fear and Longing. I reached out to my designer and like, hey, I need a book. Here's the cover. It needs to look like this. The title is Fright Night's Big City. Because I always do a play on words on a known movie or book for that series. So I've got that going on. I've got Spirits Untapped I'm still working on. And then I've got another nonfiction project, Screaming Skulls and haunted dolls and haunted objects. And another book for writers. I just released Wide for the Wind, which is a book on publishing publishing everywhere as a writer. And I'm going to do a follow-up to the 7 P's of publishing success. So those are I've got a couple anthology projects. So yeah, it never stops. It's like, how many am I going to get done this year? Who knows?
You're taking it easy now. You're on a holiday.
I'm kicking back.
Yeah, you're relaxing and stuff like that. It's interesting you have a lot of haunted. Have you had haunted experiences yourself?
A couple of weird experiences, and that was only later on. I used to be able to say, because I was on a lot of paranormal shows, and I go, nope, never had an experience, and thank God, because I'm a big chicken.
Yeah.
But yeah, Liz and I had a weird encounter in a hotel room on our way to visit a haunted sanitarium, and it was just this really bizarre experience where I thought there was a woman in the room, and I thought I saw her and heard her. Liz thought she felt her touching her and standing over her. And it was just this weird, and we didn't find out until the morning when we were talking about it. I'm like, oh my God, I thought that was just a weird dream. it wasn't spooky. It was just eerie. And we felt like she was just there with us. She wasn't threatening to us, but it was a really interesting experience because she is not a believer. Right. And normally she's the voice of reason when I'm scared of the monsters, under the bed or whatever. And this is the one time where she's like, no, I experienced something weird too, and I can't explain it.
Well, maybe it was the drinking, the drugs, and the threesome.
Oh, it could have been. No, but no, that night we hadn't done any of those three things.
So. Well, you wake up with a feeling, who knows, right?
It was more than a feeling, as Boston said.
I rest my case. There you go. Says it all. Well, it's been a great hour, great conversation, and I appreciate it. We will have your book and your website up on ours as well, so people listening can do one click and pick it up and come find you, stalk you, send you letters, whatever they like.
Naked pictures, all the things.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I love those. You know, if you don't want to send them to him, send them to me. I'll take them. Our guest today has been the author of Fear and Longing in Los Angeles, and that's Canadian Werewolf Book 3, Mark Leslie. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much, Alan. Great to chat with you and David.
Thanks, Mark.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel. A pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show is over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.